David Rogers Webb has deep experience with investigation and analysis within challenging and deceptive environments, including the mergers and acquisitions boom of the 80s, venture investing, and the public financial markets. He managed hedge funds through the period spanning the extremes of the dot-com bubble and bust, producing a gross return of more than 320% while the S&P 500 and NASDAQ indices had losses. His clients included some of the largest international institutional investors. He recently released an amazing book and a documentary with the title, The Great Taking. Now, I want to be clear on this. David is not giving you investment advice. We don't give investment advice on this show. We have no idea what your personal situation is. We're just talking what's happening in the global international markets. But David has researched and exposed the fact that our securities markets are essentially rigged against you in the case of a major financial crisis. The bottom line is that you may not own the stocks and bonds that you think you do, or really any financial asset. We brought David into the economic war room to have him explain. Those I've introduced his book, The Great Taking, and the documentary have said it is one of the scariest things they've ever seen. But there's good news. It's late in the game, but it may not be too late. And we have a solution that you may be able to use if we act quickly. David, welcome to the economic war room.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
You know, you've written a great and important book. I've been connected to Wall Street really since the 1960s. My father was a stockbroker, and he retired just a year ago. He passed away, you know, this past November. But I've seen a lot through his eyes, and then my 41-year career in the investment world with Templeton and elsewhere. And I used to get stock certificates when I'd buy stocks. In fact, my mom bought some shares of Disney just because she thought the certificate was so pretty and the artwork was so great. But now everything's electronic, everything's held in street name and pooled together. And as you explain this, at some point will likely spell trouble. But how did we get here? Can you explain how we've transitioned from used to getting stock certificates that we owned and put in a safe to where we are now?
It's been a long process, and it has been a deliberate process, executed over more than 50 years. And this began with dematerialization of securities. This was beginning in the really in the late 60s. There was a crisis created called the paperwork crisis. It's interesting when you go back and look at this that I think it was clearly orchestrated. It somehow handling paper certificates became so overwhelming that it was necessary to close the New York Stock Exchange just on Wednesdays. Following this, it took a number of years, but then the Depository Trust Corp was started in 1973. And then there was really no sufficient or significant dematerialization until the 1980s. So somehow everything ran just fine with paper certificates. But the key thing here is that if you have a certificate, there's a very bright line as to who controls it as collateral. If you sign the certificate over to your broker, put it into your account, then you can use it in your margin account to lever up your position. It's very clear that the broker then controls it as collateral. With dematerialization, holding all securities in pools, it then created the possibility for others to use the securities as collateral, which they began doing. Now, some countries, all G30 countries were pushed to dematerialize. Sweden did it in a way that protected investors. So it isn't necessarily the case that by going to electronic records, you can't keep track of who owns what. It's absolutely possible to do. So the next step was a subversion of the law, which was severing the property right to the security. This was done by creating a new concept of a security entitlement. And that was implemented in the Uniform Commercial Code in all 50 states quietly beginning in 1994. This way, there was no discussion at the federal level. Basically, no one has known about this for a few decades. But this security entitlement severs the property right and essentially makes you an unsecured creditor to get your own securities back in the event of bankruptcy in the financial system.
Now, this sounds a lot like what we're familiar with, which is the bail-in at a bank. When you go deposit money in a bank, it no longer is your money. All of a sudden, they owe you that money, and you don't have a right to it. And if the bank fails, you know, we have FDIC insurance and all that. But if the bank fails, it's not your money. You line up as a lender to the bank, and the bankruptcy judge determines when and how you get paid, who gets paid before you and after you and so forth. Is that the same kind of thing we're talking here?
It is very similar. It is a very similar concept that you do not own your securities. You have a claim, but it's a weak claim in the event of insolvency. And in Europe, I've studied all of this in Europe as well. This has now been implemented globally. Europe was pushed to conform to this U.S. model. And in the EU documents discussing how to do this, they specifically said some jurisdictions treat securities like money, the U.S. and Canada, for example. This was a document in the early 2000s in which they were saying exactly what you're saying. In the U.S. system, now securities are treated like money.
Well, you know, there's this SIPC insurance. Does that protect an investor if there's a failure?
Well, it's a fig leaf. It's just as FDIC insurance is a fig leaf. FDIC insures about 2% of insured deposits, not all deposits. It's only between $200 and $300 billion in the fund, which in the scheme of things, when banks have many, many trillions of, some banks have derivative position exposures the size of the global economy, upwards of $100 trillion of exposure in individual banks.
And that's the problem. We've got this massive debt. We're going to have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll dive into the impact the debt and all of these derivatives can have on your portfolio and what we need to be doing about it. We're talking with David Webb. He's a financial expert. He's been around for decades studying how the markets have evolved. He's made a lot of money on Wall Street, very successful investor. He's retired now, so he's not giving investment advice. But what he is doing is sharing with us the trillions of dollars of derivatives and the massive debt and how that could potentially impact your stock portfolios. So, David, you were talking about how much derivative exposure there was. Go back to that.
Okay. Well, I started becoming concerned about the scale of derivatives in the very early 2000s. And at that point, derivatives were about 100 trillion to 120 trillion, so about twice global GDP at that point. Very large. Now, by 2007, 2008, this had gone to 700 trillion. So from 100 trillion to 700 trillion in 5 years. So at that point, it was 10 times global GDP. It's now estimated that derivatives might be 2 quadrillion, which would be maybe 20 times global GDP. Now, what has enabled this is the use of all the public's securities as collateral, free of payment and without restriction. This is the public's securities are held in these vast pools without any specific identification to securities so that they can be used as collateral by others.
And this has all become legal. They've papered this over in the UCC and other laws.
They have papered it over. Initially, it was being done. It was industry practice prior to 1994. After the dematerialization, they began doing this on a big scale. But then once they they fixed it. They papered it over in the UCC in 1994. I think it's no coincidence that that is when derivative instruments just exploded, began exploding at that point. So there is a direct connection, this free use of collateral. People should understand they're intimidated by the term derivative, and it is kind of intimidating, but it is basically, it's a contract. It's not a real thing itself. It's not a security itself. It is just a contract written about the behavior of something else that results in a payment between parties in one direction or another. So originally, this was done for things like farmers selling their crops forward at a future date. There was actually a societal purpose to these contracts. But now this has been set up, I believe, in order to take the real things. So the derivative contracts are not real things themselves, but through this very sophisticated scheme, they can be used to take the real securities and assets from others.
Yeah. Now, let me jump in here. In the movie, you gave an analogy. It was an amazing analogy. You said, imagine you go to your car dealer, you pay cash for the car, you buy the car, you drive it home, you drive it for a couple of years, you think it's yours, and then somebody comes up, shows up with a piece of paper and repos it from you. And what you didn't know is the car dealer had secured all of their loans, debt, or whatever with the cars they had sold, and you'd signed in that agreement, and they just take it from you. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. And, you know, you and I talked about this before. People get concerned about their cars when they hear this analogy. And there's good news and bad news here. The good news is it's not about your car. The bad news is it's much worse because it's about the global financial system and all securities. So the securities of individual investors, as well as securities held in investment funds, in pension plans, investors that are sophisticated, that have been told that their securities are segregated. We know from a Federal Reserve document, which was a response to something called the Legal Certainty Group in Europe. This was in 2006, that even segregated accounts are not protected. They will receive only a pro rata share of what remains in the pool after the secured creditors take the securities.
Now, here's the even scarier part, is even the most sophisticated investors don't realize. They think they've hedged themselves. Okay, so I'm perfectly hedged. If the market goes down, then I'm covered with this derivative and that derivative, not realizing that they may not own even those things that they think they own.
Well, the problem is that, you know, every crisis has been used to put another piece in place in this scheme. And the 2008 financial crisis was used to create central clearing counterparties. And these are massive clearing exchanges where all derivative contracts are centrally cleared. Now, the problem is these things have been designed to fail. They have essentially no capitalization under them. They've concentrated all the risk onto these things so that if these sophisticated institutions, as you're saying, think that they've hedged their downside risk in the derivatives market, if the central clearing counterparties fail, then they have no protection.
No, that's that. And this is what we saw. You know, you said this started in 2008. What I did when I was doing my research for the Pentagon and put into the book I wrote, A Secret Weapon, this is so far beyond the understanding of even sophisticated investors. Warren Buffett said, for example, that derivatives were financial weapons of mass destruction. Well, they were a fraction then of what they are today. We are much more exposed to these weapons of mass destruction. Jim Rickards has said, you know, here's the problem. In the Asian financial crisis, we Wall Street bailed that out. And then in 2008, Wall Street got bailed out by the central banks. Who bails out the central banks? What you're telling us is the central banks have all planned for this. They bailed themselves out with your money.
Yes, this is what has been done here is to take what had been property for four centuries, make that a contractual claim, and take the derivatives, which are contracts that never would have had a security interest, and to give the secured creditors behind those super priority to take the assets out of these pools. So it's a very sophisticated sleight of hand. Where the failure is actually necessary for them to take everything.
Well, we're going to have to take a break. When we come back, we'll dive even deeper. David, at the end of the last segment, you made a claim. You said that the failure is necessary. You've written a book called The Great Taking. The failure is necessary for The Great Taking, which, you know, to me, I hear World Economic Forum, you will own nothing by the year 2030 and be happy about it. Now, the only way that I would be happy about it if I own nothing is if I got somehow out of a crisis and it was a way to survive. In your movie, you talk about the central bank digital currency, which I think is what their game plan is, where we end up owning nothing. We just have a use rights right, even to our money. It's all electronic, and we'll all take it because we'll all be desperate for it. Can you dive into that? Tell us what you think is coming ahead.
Well, we're in a global hybrid war now. It is full spectrum. The threats toward us are myriad at this point. We're going into an escalating global conventional war. That is happening. But it's a hybrid war in the sense that it's not a war between nation states. It is something much bigger than that. And I would submit that the real power behind all of this is the very small group of people that control the private central banks. And it is their unlimited ability to create money that gives them this power to control all governments, all media, except yours, all political parties, all sides. And the central banks have always been joined at the hip. They're born in warfare. They're joined at the hip with warfare and the debt that escalates. And also with totalitarianism. They've funded every totalitarian collectivist government and consistently. So that is really what we're facing right now.
Well, I was just at Jekyll Island. I visited the Jekyll Island Club and went into the Federal Reserve Room and saw the photos on the wall, visited Indian Mount, which was Rockefeller's mansion that he holds there. You know, and the history of this dating back to 1910 when they came up with this idea of the Federal Reserve, and then 1913 when it was implemented. But more recently, we've seen a pushback. People are saying, I don't want this. And you've been a part of efforts to reform the Uniform Commercial Code, the UCC, in varying states. Can you explain, what can we do about the Great Taking? How do we fight back?
This is very, very important because the subversion of the property rights are absolutely fundamental to freedom. If you don't have rights to property, you're very vulnerable. And that's why they're doing this. And the Ed Griffin, I actually visited with him recently. He said to me, property rights are so deep in us that it is even in other species. You know, it has something to do with the ability to reproduce, having security and stability. The right to securities as property, we can tell they're going after other types of property as well, but the securities issue, this was subverted in local law in every case. The individual nations in the EU and all 50 states. And it is actually a shockingly simple thing to see when you actually look at the language in the UCC. It's plain as day, the deception, and it is very simple to fix it. And all that has to be done is, so this may take a moment to explain. What they did was to say that entitlement holders have priority over the secured creditors. And for example, I went to South Dakota when they were beginning the process of hearing the bill, and I heard the bank lobbyists read only that much and stop. What they left out was it then goes on and says, except. And then you go to another period paragraph, and in the exception, that also begins that the entitlement holders have priority over the secured creditors, except. So you have to drill down three levels, and then you find that the secured creditors have priority all the time over the entitlement holders. So the simple thing is to eliminate the exception. You just strike it out. The entitlement holders have priority all the time. And it's as simple as this. They have priority to their own assets, to get their own assets in the event of insolvency. So this this process has begun. It was really prevented. The bill was prevented from being heard in South Dakota. Rep. Julie Auk is a very courageous woman who is the first in the world to begin the process of rolling this back, but we were able to observe the tactics of the banking lobby. They basically just flat out lied, and they had some help in the legislative process to prevent the bill from being heard. Now this process is beginning in Tennessee. There are other states that are advancing this as well, and I don't think there's any way to stop it now.
That's fabulous. In fact, we're seeing something similar with our pirate money, which is transactional gold and silver under Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution, which would take us back to money issued by a state, so a government rather than a private entity like the private banks. It would take us back to a limited supply of money that people could actually transact in. We're proving it. But we had the exact same thing when we first brought it up. It mysteriously stopped, even though it was very popular. I think our solution, David, is to get your voice heard in every corner of America, at the hedge fund level and at the average everyday person going shopping at Walmart level, because they all own securities either through pension funds or an IRA or something, and we've got to light this up. So I want to thank you for all of the work that you're doing. And we're going to pull in with those people that are working on the Uniform Commercial Code and support them in your good efforts there. We've got to win this battle. That's why we're an economic war room. We're an economic war room not to come up with, you know, here's the problems, but also to come up with real solutions. And David, you've done a great job of bringing real solutions. Where can people find your work?
Well, there's a website, thegreattaking.com. And you can find links to, well, the PDF of the book is free. And that's how this has really spread globally. Zero friction. You know, so that has been free for anyone to have. There are print books available through Lulu. Some people just want a print book there, and there's a very low price. It's just the cost of getting the book.
Thank you, David. Hey, we're going to summarize all this in our free economic battle plan. You can get a copy at economicwarroom.com. Remember, what we see as a marketplace, our enemies view as a battle space. This is Kevin Freeman from the Economic War Room.